folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. I think we've got a really good show for you today. Mike Cosentino is sitting across from me.
Hola, Paco. ¿Qué tal? Yeah, these are fun shows. We're going to talk politics. We're going to talk political futures. And this is one of those nice political discussions that everybody likes to have. Yeah.
I didn't have to do any research, hardly. I read a few articles, and that's it this
morning.
Not
that you would have anyway, but...
No, I usually sleep through the shows. So, Klaus, are you there? You want to introduce our guest? Because Dan's been on the show now twice before.
Yeah, let me introduce Dan. Dan has become a quasi-regular on Democratic Perspective. Dan got a degree in history from Harvard and then a PhD from Columbia, and he taught at Hobart William Smith Colleges and is retired now and is working on his fifth book, Dan, is it?
It's a big book, but it's on American thought.
Right.
Today, the thought we're talking about, right, Klaus, is the political election coming up. Now, we've been avoiding doing political election shows week after week after week after week. So it's been a while since we've done it. We've been working on topics like health care and local issues. You're the guy who invited this character on, right, Klaus?
Let's start, Dan, with something that everybody's talking about right now, which is who will be the vice presidential candidate and who should be the vice presidential candidate?
Well, I'm actually thinking that's less important because Biden is going to win no matter who he picks. I had predicted when I was on the show previously that he would pick Stacey Abrams because he had thought about making her his running mate 2 years ago when he was first contemplating entering the race. They had met and he had thought about announcing right at the start that she would be his running mate, and then they decided no, that wouldn't be a good thing, it would look weak. So I thought he'd go back to her, but now that does not look like it's going to happen. I have a feeling that they're not happy with most of the African-American candidates they've been considering because they just added a new one to their vetting list, and that's Karen Bass, the congresswoman from California, who has a very strong record and would be, I think, extremely good. And I would assume she's a major contender because they're now vetting her as quickly as they can. My favorite, I don't know if she's in the running or not, but it's your next-door neighbor, Michelle Lewin Grisham, the governor of New Mexico.
Oh, yeah. I've heard talk about her.
She is Hispanic. She is definitely being vetted. And it seems to me that going after the Hispanic vote would be very smart at the moment. It could produce victories in Texas and really a lot of other states. She would help out in Georgia.
Wow.
She would help out in Florida for sure. And she'd be a very good person. I think you look at the map of the coronavirus right now and just about all of the bottom of the country is lit up, except New Mexico. And that's because of the incredible job she's done. So I think she would be a great choice. I don't know, though, how serious she is being considered.
I agree with your first statement to some extent, which it matters less now. I don't know what Mike thinks. Let's find out what Mike thinks. But I think it matters less now who's the vice president, because Biden is ahead by so much. And I think this, frankly, if I was in Biden's shoes, this gives me a lot of freedom of who I want to be my vice president.
Exactly.
I don't have to pick somebody from a particular state or a particular race or a particular ethnicity.
Right.
I really have a lot of choice at this point because I think I can win this with whoever I nominate. So what you really want is the best person you can get your hands on.
Well, that's it. I think a couple of things before we go on here. I want to interject that I said before the show that I know why he didn't choose Stacey Abrams, and it's going to sound terrible, especially on a show Democratic Perspective. But in my discussions of the last couple of months about who Biden might pick, the Stacey Abrams optics. As soon as he showed favor for Abrams, I'm guessing his handlers have been working on him to consider others. The Stacey Abrams, the optics and the history, her abilities are unquestioned. But at least as far as the country today. It's probably wise to move on, at least for maximum effect from the vice presidential candidate.
Dan, let me ask you another question that, you know, people bandy around. You know, obviously, Biden has a substantial lead in the polls, and I'm not sure offhand how that is in the swing states, but people are saying, yeah, and so did Hillary. And don't pay that much attention to the polls. What's your response to that?
Well, I think we're going to have a landslide election for the Democrats. And the reason I think that is this is now showing all the signs of being what political scientists call a critical election. And by that, they do not mean an important election. All elections are important. It means an election in which there is a significant realignment of voting blocks, such that a new coalition, a new majority coalition gets formed. And that's how our politics runs. As a historian, I can trace this back to 1800. I don't think you want me to. But,
how about sticking with this century, Dan, and give us another example?
Well, I would go back to 1968, which was the last real critical election, in which you had a situation going in which the Republicans controlled the suburbs and college-educated vote. That was their big mainstay. They controlled the Bible Belt. They controlled the entire West. In 1968, if you look at California, Oregon, the whole Mountain West, it was all Republican solidly. And in 1968, they won over half the working class, but most importantly, won the South. They brought the South with them as a reaction to the civil rights movement.
Right.
And the Democrats were left with what came to be called the McGovern Coalition, which wasn't much. It had African Americans, to be sure, very loyal. It had still half the working class. It had liberals for whatever they're worth. And we tend to forget this, but it had the rural areas, the farm vote, because farmers saw the Democrats as their dependable ally in getting farm aid. So that was the Democratic coalition. It was a minority coalition, and as a result, you had big losses. Now, that, however, got messed up. That whole alignment got messed up because of Watergate. And so in 1976, the true accidental president, Jimmy Carter, managed to win election, and he brought the South back with him. But that was only for one year, one election, because in 1980, Ronald Reagan recreated and cemented the 1968 coalition, and he just cemented the South to the Republican Party.
Why isn't that a critical election, Dan? Reagan's election seems to be an absolute turning point because Now, when we look at Nixon's policy, they were positively liberal.
Because what he did was to recreate the coalition that Nixon had brought into being. So, yes, it was. It was sort of a two-part critical election, 68 and 80. But what happened in 80 was that the original critical election in 1968 got reconfirmed and strengthened. Would you agree on that? That's really what happened.
I think so. I see it as the complete consolidation of the conservative rural and southern strategy, the getting a large portion of the working class. Of course, Reagan was from California. That had a lot of advantages. Why is this election critical? I mean, what are the coalitions? You see Trump's coalition kind of collapsing underneath him, that he's keeping his... Dan, hang on a second. Let me finish.
Not all of it. Some of it is real, real firm. The big difference this time is that suburban college-educated voters across the Sun Belt will be in the Democratic column. They have been moving there.
Lost him. Hey, Klaus, we lost Dan there for a second.
Movement every year.
Is he back? Yeah. Hang on, Dan. Hang on.
Yeah.
He's back now. Everything's solid. Okay. We lost you there. You lost the connection for a minute. So go ahead and sort of repeat everything you say twice.
A couple of sentences.
Well,
go back a little bit.
The key point is that in the original Nixon-Reagan coalition, you had the South and the West solidly in the Democratic camp. I'm sorry, the Republican camp.
Right.
What's happening now, it started to happen, it began under Clinton. It's been a slow movement. But suburban college-educated voters, first in the North, then in the Midwest, and certainly on the West Coast, shifted over to the Democratic Party. So that was going on for the last 20 years. And we saw that especially in 2008 with the Obama election. And then what's happening now is you're seeing that same group, college-educated suburban voters. They are very numerous. They come out to vote. They're very, very powerful. They are now shifting clearly into the Democratic column.
Hey, amen.
Yeah, yay!
That's your answer.
They're going to be very good on most issues. The one thing Democrats will have to be careful with is fiscal issues. They do not like deficits, but they're willing to spend for social investment. So if it's presented the right way, they'll be happy. They'll do infrastructure, they'll do education, they'll do science and technology. They're very, very, very concerned about climate change, and they're willing to spend there, say, for a Green New Deal. That appeals to them. But you have to understand that they don't like deficits. So Biden is going to have to...
They're probably not going to like income redistribution that much either, Dan.
No, they don't. They don't like redistribution. They like something that's a real investment in the future in some way.
All right. So a couple of questions, and maybe Klaus has some, and Mike, but is... How is COVID affecting the election, and how are all these Black Lives Matter demonstrations affecting the election, the choice of candidate? What's happening with I'm asking five questions here, what's happening with the candidates that are down ticket? Because that's very important to us here in Arizona.
That was my question.
These are critical questions, very important. And the basic answer is that the pandemic is accelerating this movement of college-educated suburban voters into the Democratic Party across the Sun Belt. They're already in the Democratic Party in the northern tier of the country, but now running all the way from San Diego and Los Angeles to Phoenix to the big cities in Texas to Florida, even Charleston, South Carolina, you're seeing this. And all of these places, of course, are where the virus is really striking home right now. This is where the pandemic has become an emergency. And it's these voters in particular who didn't want to open early, who are upset with the way Trump has handled this, who are now outraged because it's really affecting their lives. So I think it's going to accelerate and help cement this movement to the Democratic Party.
How about Black Lives Matter demonstrations, Dan? We've never seen so much support from just basic, ordinary white folks for redressing these grievances. We haven't since the Civil Rights Movement, anyway.
Well, those are primarily college-educated, often younger, suburban people, right? And many of them are quite willing to support Black Lives Matter. They're outraged at police treatment of blacks. So this is also helping to cement the new coalition. This is an area where these white suburbanites love to believe, and in most cases they are, essentially non-racist and willing to work on this issue. So this is also helping to move the to build the coalition.
A lot of them are city people, Dan.
I should point one other thing out. I missed one historical point, and that is the critical elections take place in years when you have a major crisis, when the country is in terrible chaos for one reason or another. A war, a depression, a big social movement. And what we have in 2020 is a confluence of about all these things except for war.
George Bush would have been a one-term president if not for 9/11.
Exactly.
He was so freaking stupid. It was hard to. Anyway,
he's been exceeded now.
He really is.
He looks like a good president compared to what we got now.
Yeah. I don't know. He looked
not good, but not as.
I want yeah, really
not as far down the scale as we once thought.
He looks like Noam Chomsky now. He looks like a genius. I do want to talk. This is a dangerous path. This is a real. I want to say this up front here. If 20 minutes into the show, you know, because liberals believing that that Biden's going to win, that's going to be a landslide. This is a dangerous conversation because they won't turn out. I mean, 2016 was all about turnout. Every election's about turnout, I guess, but. I'm really uncomfortable. I mean, you can't stop this kind of thing. I saw just yesterday the polls in 20 battleground states. You know, Biden's ahead in double digits in some of them. It's just what I'm afraid of. What an historian would say is polls don't vote. People do.
Can I comfort you?
Please.
Can I tell you
Please
why I'm
me.
Less worried about that? Two reasons. First of all, there is incredible animus against Donald Trump. You cannot imagine what a source of motivation that is going to be. You're going to have so many people who can't wait to vote. To vote against Trump. I think that's a huge motivator. And negative political reasons are usually stronger than positive ones.
Right.
People vote against candidates, right?
So, I mean, Biden doesn't even have to run negative ads. Trump's already there.
Yeah, he does. Trump runs his own negative ad every day.
Biden actually doesn't seem to have to do anything at this point.
Right.
But watch.
He is running hard-hitting ads, though.
I know he is. But he almost doesn't seem to have to.
My other point, though, other key point on the question of turnout. Trump is now in a terrible trap. He decided to go full force for opening up the economy. And he got all of his lieutenants in the Republican state governors to go along with him. So they opened up like crazy. And now the virus is spreading like wildfire. And they're in a terrible trap because the only way to control the virus will be another lockdown.
Right.
Probably for 30 to 60 days, which will cause, again, massive unemployment. It will destroy the economy to do that.
Let's take a second, Dan.
If you don't do that, the case rate is going to skyrocket to unknown heights.
In Arizona, our governor was pretty good. And then Trump came to visit or planned to come to visit, and he moved, Mike might correct me, he moved the opening 2 weeks ahead because Trump was coming to visit here.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know that he was all that good because he prohibited localities from having their own rules and prohibited, in fact, that people established requirements for wearing face masks. So I don't think he was pretty good. I think he was terrible.
We have very low standards, Klaus, for Arizona governors.
So he
could have been worse. Let's put it that way.
His original date was May 15th. Trump comes to town, and quite frankly, and I posted this on Arizona political websites, and people agree, Trump offered him the Republican convention. And even sent a couple of people out after he left, if he would open up. So sure enough, Ducey opens up in the first week of May rather than May 15th. And as we know, in this particular madness of pandemic, those 2 weeks were 10 days, 12 days, whatever it was, were critical. If he would have waited to May 15th, we could still probably be in trouble, but not nearly as bad as we are now.
And a lot of this is Trump's influence.
That trap is going on. That trap is in.
And within 48 hours of opening up the state, Trump gives the convention to Jacksonville.
Well, yeah, but that's less important than the fact that it opened up too early.
That's
under
right.
Republican dynamics. And as a result, everyone, all the college-educated voters that are so critical, who are there in Maricopa County, are smart enough to be able to follow this.
Let's hope so. And it would be nice to turn the state.
I think they can. And they will understand what's happened here. And I think they already do. And all the polling of them indicated they were worried about opening up too soon.
I think an awful lot of us are.
Majorities.
And let me switch for a moment. What do you think will be Biden's first and main legislative priorities, and especially as it comes to taxes, and readdressing this huge gap where the rich pay much less percentage-wise than your average American?
I think the Biden administration is going to look a lot like the New Deal in the sense that you're going to get one new piece of legislation after the next. I think they're going to end up with a substantial majority in the Senate, maybe not 60 votes, but 54, 55 senators, I think. And they're going to have a lot of leeway. They're going to be able to use what's called reconciliation. There's just so much they're going to do. But one of the things I think they'll definitely do is repeal the entire Trump tax bill. That's going. I think they're going to be moving on climate change. They're going to be moving on infrastructure. They're going to be moving on all sorts of things to promote recovery, stimulus. But the stimulus will have in it all sorts of goodies, just the way the 2008 stimulus did, only it will be so much bigger. Everyone agrees the stimulus in 2008 was too small. The Biden one will be gigantic, and it will contain pretty much the Democratic wish list. The thing to remember with Biden is his top advisor, the person he's closest to, and that's an economist named Jared Bernstein, which few people know. But he was Biden's chief economic advisor when Biden was vice president. Politically, he's probably closer to Bernie Sanders than he is to Biden. He's quite progressive. But he also believes, along with Biden, that you have to propose things that can actually pass. So they make a terrific team. He'll be the chief economic advisor, but beyond that, I'll predict he's going to be the chief advisor, period. And so keep an eye on Jared Bernstein. He writes op-eds periodically for the Washington Post and other publications, and he's going to be the key to what Biden does.
We know him, Dan, and I can't remember. I think in the end he didn't come on the show early. I think early in the when we were inviting a lot of economists, we may have actually done a show with him. It would have been very short when we first started, 15 minutes long instead of 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know who he is. I do read his editorials and stuff. Can Biden in one sweep undo all of Trump's
executive orders?
Exactly, Mike. Good, thank you.
There's some legal problems. You have to have 90-day warnings. You have to do various things. So it will take a year, but he will get started on it. The interesting thing about Biden as a candidate, he hasn't had to campaign. So he's been just sitting there in his house, operating as he would if he were sitting in the Oval Office. And he's been on the phone with his advisors. The report in the Times was that he spends an hour every day with Jared Bernstein. And they're plotting what they're going to do as of January 20th. So I think you're going to see them ready to spring into action. And a lot of stuff will get done very quickly by the standard.
Dan, that's the best news that you've said so far, that they
terrible condition.
That they are plotting what they're going to do January 20th, because that's what as I walk around thinking about the future and thinking about the hell that we're in and how we're going to be saved, one of the things you hope is happening is that planning for the future.
Well, to say the least, they're doing that. I mean, Biden is spending 8 to 10 hours a day doing just that.
I hope he's going to land on
exactly
running.
What his moves are over the first year.
How much damage, people ask me, people who are not really that deeply involved in politics, is how much damage can Trump do the country before he is replaced, if he is replaced?
That's a good question. Well, that's on a lot of people's minds anyway.
I wouldn't put anything past him.
Yeah.
Except war. He doesn't like to get involved in a shooting war. We've seen that.
Okay.
He's sort of a coward. He shies away.
Yeah, that's good news.
He makes loud noises and then he basically backs down. But in terms of the economy, in terms of immigration, race, he wants to appeal to his base, and his base now is very small. You know, he's got the Bible Belt, he's got rural areas, he has the Mountain West, sorry Klaus, and he has about half the working class, and that's it. I mean, it's like the McGovern coalition. So he is going to be working on the things that he believes will please that group, that fairly small coalition, and the rest of us aren't going to like it. On the other hand, it's going to contribute to the Biden landslide as he does that.
Let me remind people, we're talking to Daniel J. Singal of Hobart and William Smith College, and a historian with degrees and everything. And here on Democratic Perspective this morning, we're trying to do exactly what the name of our show implies. We're trying to take a Democratic perspective on the upcoming election. And we're talking, one of the conclusions Dan started with is that this is a critical election for lots of reasons. Liberals think it's a critical election because fascism is looming around every corner in the Trump administration. But it's critical because of a realignment of coalitions. We don't think of American politics as coalitions like other countries. However, it is. And we're talking about the sea change of coalitions that is happening in 2020 and that are going to lean the liberal way, and it has to go that way. We're talking about the United States became the envy of the world because it was a liberal democracy. And by liberal democracy, I mean we didn't wrap up our women. We gave them the vote. I'm not talking about Marxism here. I'm just talking about the freedom of the press and the things that we enjoyed here in the United States. We became the envy of the world. A lot of those things are fading and will continue to fade, and people can see that. One of the things, Dan, and then I'm going to turn this back to you. You're talking about the college-educated suburban voter, the college-education urban voter. You're talking about a state here in Arizona where we're talking about 35% maybe have been to college, or at least have completed college. As far as the body politic, it's not, I mean, it's there, obviously, and most of them live in Maricopa and Pima County, Phoenix and Tucson. Places like here, Sedona, of course, has an way outsized college-educated population, which is one of the reasons I think Democrats have been so successful here. Democrats have not been as successful. So I live in Cottonwood, by the way. We have not been as successful on the other side. I end up begging people to, hey, working in Sedona is a piece of cake, for liberal causes. Come over where it's hard. Anyway, go ahead, Dan.
Well, let me just give you some figures from Maricopa.
Okay.
Because I think it tells you what. Maricopa is an enormous county.
It's huge.
And in 2016, Trump won it. But he won it by 45,000 votes. Fairly small.
Wow, that's a very small percentage.
2018, your wonderful senator, and I mean that, Kyrsten Sinema, won it by 60,000 votes. So there was a shift of 100,000 votes in Maricopa in those 2 years. The polls now, from a very good pollster, Arizona pollster, Mark Noble, suggest that Biden and Mark Kelly are both leading in Maricopa by double digits. So think about that. You go from Trump winning it by a small margin in 2016 to a double-digit win for the Democrats in 2020.
Yeah.
That's what I would call a political shift.
Big.
Dan, let me ask
that's
another.
Why I'm so confident.
Sure.
And
we're talking
again,
about a 57 square mile.
Maricopa are the ones who are getting hit hardest by the pandemic, who are most outraged by what's happening, who are very worried about the economy. So I think they're coming over, and they're going to be cemented on the Democratic side.
Klaus?
Dan, what do you think about the theory that gets periodically banded around that Trump will not recognize the election, that he'll refuse to leave the White House, that he'll say that it was an illegal election because this, that, and the other. Do you think that's likely to happen? And if it were to happen, how would it play out?
It would be more likely to happen if the election is close. If it's very close, and if he can start calling for recounts and just strengths things out and claim fraud. I think it's going to be such an overwhelming rejection of him across the country that he will not be in a position to do that.
Well, that's it. Most states have a number. It's got to be under 1%. It's got to be very close or they won't recount.
Yeah, exactly. So I suspect he also, in an interview, it was an interesting interview a couple of weeks ago, he said, if I'm beat, I'm beat. I'll go home.
I heard that.
I have other things to do, he said.
That's good news.
He wants to start his own radio network.
I won't work for him. I want to mention that Adrian Fontes is the Maricopa County recorder, and this is a big deal. He's a Democrat. He's been on our show. He's come up here to Sedona to speak once or twice. Him and his mom have been on our show, actually. His mom used to own a little bodega down in downtown Phoenix that my children frequented.
And his brother-in-law and his sister-in-law.
Well, we won't get into ethnic slurs here, but the Adrian Fontes is the Maricopa County recorder. And if there's a chance at having a fair election in Maricopa County, believe me, Adrian is going to protect it.
I think there are people like him across the country who feel the same way. I think generally state secretaries of state and local election supervisors tend to be very good.
Well, that's the other thing that happened. Katie Hobbs, the Secretary of State, is a Democrat. Now, not in Arizona. That's second in line to the governorship, which is one of the reasons Ducey didn't go to work for Trump, some people think. But the idea is, so you got Secretary of State, Democrat, you got the county recorder as a Democrat. But the first thing the Republican Arizona legislature did after she got elected was do everything they could to limit the powers of the Secretary of State. I don't know how successful they were.
I don't either, Mike. Trump has taken a whole lot of people down the rabbit hole with him into all the stuff about fake news. The man is basically a crook, and so he can't have anybody, inspector generals, looking into what he's doing. He can't have any honest, independent politicians working any position of importance for him. But some of the things I read recently in the Times, some of his supporters sound positively delusional in their belief system and in their commitments to Donald Trump.
The best way to cure that is a massive electoral defeat.
Yes.
And reality will set in, especially when they see what will follow. The interesting thing, you look at that recent Times poll that came out last week, Times Siena College, which is a very good polling organization, by the way, they found Trump support at 36%. 36%, and I think it's falling.
Well, according,
it has been falling. He was up in the 40s, and now he's dropping into the 30s. So, I think yes, there are those people, but they're not going to count for as much in the future.
Klaus, do you have a question for Dan?
No, I was just reminded I was in Germany in. I forget what year it was, the year of the hanging Chad. And people in Germany said, why don't you just have a central election operation like we do so that everything is uniform? And I said at the time, and I didn't realize how prophetic it was, I said one of the strengths of America is that you have all of these local election administrators, so you can't really... There's no way to tell them what to do.
Well, that's why the Voting Rights Act became such a huge thing. Arizona operated its elections under the Voting Rights Act. You know, we always think of Alabama, Mississippi. No, Arizona was also was operating under a Justice Department oversight in its elections for many, many years because we were found to have violated the Voting Rights Act. Now, when they gutted the Voting Rights Act, I think it's been 9 years since the Voting Rights Act has been essentially gutted. And what we're seeing is the insanity, like in Kentucky, with hundreds of polling places being closed, with a single polling place for 100,000 voters, and things like this, things that at least won't happen. I'm going to tell you guys, it's 90 some odd days until ballots start. So let me say that again. First week of October, ballots start dropping in Arizona. We're talking 3 months plus a week or two. Now, first of all, we take great comfort in that.
Sounds right.
Yes. 95 days.
There are 10 other states in which they start voting 45, 46 days before.
Oh,
so there are a number of big states in which the voting is going to start mid-September. So we're 2.5 months away from the start of the election.
I hope that one of the things the Democrats will do would do something about this, all the gerrymandering, and I know they participated and done their share of it, but the whole voter rights issue, once they get in power, I hope they can, hope they can right that, because it's getting more Byzantine and more, it's more and more, Dan, don't you think more and more a part of the Republican strategy to keep down the vote?
Absolutely. I think it's actually a very intelligent strategy on the part of Republicans, given what's facing them. But, I think as Democrats take power, and my thought is they're going to take power in a very big way, that's going to be among the first things they address. You know, I left out a very important part of the emerging Democratic coalition. We haven't mentioned it. Youth voters. There are so many younger voters who are inclined to be liberal socially, very strong believers in racial justice and climate change and so forth, who are entering the electorate in growing numbers every year. There's a huge, now of course they haven't voted that much in the past, but you think about millennials who barely voted in 2008, who are going to be 27% of the electorate this time.
They could change it all if they want.
Our people.
I do think youth attitudes and values really undid the whole anti-gay agenda.
Yep.
What the youth just would not, absolutely 90% of them, 80%, 70%, would not go along with this whole anti-gay stuff. They just didn't believe in it. And I think that cracked politicians to a degree when they saw they're just – the people coming up just weren't going to do that.
I want to jump back to the last point. You're talking about 36%, which I have no idea why, but still, at least poll-wise.
That was the New York Times.
The number we're looking for, according to our inside guy in the Arizona House, and I'm going to cite my source, I hope Tom O'Halloran doesn't mind being cited, that 32%, he said if his approval rating falls to 32%, then Republicans will run like mad. He will be abandoned at every level. Because when these guys and their staffs crunch the numbers, it's that 32-33% where he starts dragging everybody down with him. And that 36
which
is not that
hoping for, Mike.
36 is not that far from 32. What I'm doing is supporting our guests. Our guest this morning, Daniel J. Singal, historian professor, is telling us that we're looking at a Democratic landslide, which I'm afraid of. But he said he's calmed my fears on that. When you listen to the podcast of the show, you can go back and listen to what he said about that. But the idea is that at Trump at 36%, at 32%. No Republicans win. A dog catcher, mayors, everybody goes out.
Dan, you have a minute and a half. Last thoughts?
I think that's exactly right. But they're running out of time to desert the ship. You know, the time for doing that was maybe 6 months ago, but we're down to literally 2.5 months before voting starts.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit hard to abandon your standard bearer.
They were terrified to do anything. I mean, when you saw the impeachment.
Capable of anything in desperation, but I think they're running out of time to save themselves. And again, they have this trap of the coronavirus.
Ah, good point.
I think that's a good point.
It's going to be clobbering them.
Right. Well, he can't do the silly rallies that the media, regardless left or right, seems feel compelled to cover. Why they cover these Nazi rallies, I have no idea. But I understand. I was in journalism, and then it's news is news.
Got to. We got 1 minute, Mike.
Right. Okay. We want to deeply thank Klaus von Studerheim for bringing us this wonderful guest. This is a knowledgeable historian who's not afraid to talk politics. We want to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks for being a supporter of Democratic Perspective. We want to remind everybody that Democratic Perspective has podcasts galore. First of all, we're on Facebook, Democratic Perspective page on Facebook. You can find our shows there. You can look at the top of my head for 45 minutes if you like. Or my nose, that's the only two things that show. But we also have a web page, vvid.org, Verde Valley Independent Democrats.org. Check out our podcast. See you next time, folks. Thanks. Democratic Perspective.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.